Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing The Empty Man, which is about a tulpa. I guess that's the simplest way to pull it.
You know, tulpas.
Tulpology, the study of tulpa. A tulpa, for those of you who don't, read Reddit or fucking whatever. It's basically a being that has been conjured out of pure thought.
Yeah, my hazy creepypasta inflected...
Yeah, it's a creepypasta thing.
My hazy creepypasta inflected memory of it was that it was kind of a Jungian shadow self. It's like an alter ego that you conjure up out of thin air. It's a creepy, creepypasta conceit because if you're an imaginative 14-year-old reading Spoop on the internet at 2 in the morning, you think, oh no, I have an imagination. What if I accidentally make a tulpa just by thinking about it? Oh no, now I can't not think about it. I'm making him stronger. And that ball starts rolling and gathering momentum, and then you've spooked yourself. And that's what creepypasta is all about. You do all of the heavy lifting. The pasta itself is just there to get the ball rolling most of the time.
Yeah, one more noteworthy example of a tulpa, at least in some conceptions, is Slenderman. I've heard of Slenderman being referred to as a tulpa, both like in-universe and outside of it, almost.
I haven't, but that doesn't surprise me. There's a lot of creepypasta cross-pollination going on. The big pastas kind of exert a gravitational pull and pull other pastas into their orbit.
Right. Is the concept of a tulpa a big SCP thing, or is it
probably
not?
I'm not an expert by any means, but I think the one creepypasta, it might have just been called Tulpa. The one creepypasta about a tulpa I can remember reading was set in like a lab environment, which was also in vogue back in the day, you know, Russian sleep experiment style.
Yeah.
So it's quite possible. And Slenderman, like it's a surname. I started doing that ironically, and now I just lapse into it without being able to help myself.
Are you hiding from Slenderman?
Hello, Internet. Braden here.
Slenderman, he is also piggybacking, like so many pasta monsters and just boogeymen more broadly, on the old Freddy Krueger idea, that Pennywise. Your belief in him strengthens him.
Yeah.
So and that is very much a tulpa thing.
Yeah.
And a Nightmare on Elm Street thing and an It thing.
So there's more to The Empty Man than just it's about a tulpa, but it's seemed the pithiest way to give you a log line about a movie that has a lot going on and is over 2 hours long.
Well, with the title and with the opening scene, you think that you have a Bye-Bye Man or a Slenderman-esque experience in store for you, but the boogeyman, the titular boogeyman, is kind of just window dressing in this movie.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a Trojan horse.
Yeah.
So I'll explain what I mean by that at length as we go on. We open in Bhutan in 1995. There's a, I think, quartet, 1, 2, 3, 4, of hikers, one of whom has gone into a crevice and not returned. Another one rappels down after him, finds him sitting cross-legged in front of an ominous, fossilized, semi-human skeleton.
Yeah.
It's like a human, but 20% bigger, maybe.
Well, yeah, it's 20% bigger. It might have, like, wing-like structures. It's got too many ribs. You know, it's just...
It's like the space jockey from Alien. Those kind of vibes.
Yes.
A long-dead, semi-human something or other. And the guy who went in first is totally transfixed by it. His buddy tries to make him snap out of it. Guy on the ground says, "If you touch me, you'll die." Guy isn't too put off by that. I mean, he's disconcerted, but he doesn't take it seriously.
I just want to convey that Matt's delivery of that line made it sound like the knight in Last Crusade almost, but it's
he chose poorly.
Yeah. It's much less theatrical than that. It's nearly inaudible.
Yes.
He has to say it twice, in fact, both for his friend's benefit and for ours, I think. I don't think I had an idea of what he said the first time, but I wasn't sure until he repeated it.
And the look on his face indicates that he has no sense of whether he's saying it inaudibly, semi-audibly, screaming it, not saying it at all. We get the sense that less than 10% of what he's thinking is actually coming out of his mouth. I mean, he's not all there. His face is on screensaver mode.
I think it's here, and if it's not right here, then it's not long after this that we get the first instance of a very much recurring feature of this film. Somebody, in this case, the guy, whispering just kind of gibberish, like... Speaking the last episode as I was about weird ASMR mouth sounds for the score, here it's not part of the score, it's diegetic audio, and it's also, for my money, more effective.
Yeah, in my notes I dubbed him an ASMR incubus, because there's a scene momentarily where he's squatting on top of someone as they sleep, doing that in their ear.
Which is another thing, it's a subset of this recurring event. People aren't always asleep when someone is whispering this stuff into their ear. Sometimes they're awake, but again, the whispering happens all the time. The whispering into an ear happens several times.
It's a 2-hour and 17-minute movie. There's a lot of time for these things to recur in various permutations.
Right.
So, obviously, given what I just said, they get him out of the hole. A fireman carry him over a rickety rope bridge, and they find an abandoned house in the middle of the tundra. And they take shelter and bed down for the night. He's still catatonic. And then in the night, he does the ASMR incubus routine to one of his fellow hikers.
The next day, we get very ostentatious.
Day one.
Day two.
Day two. I'm sorry.
Day three. Well, I'm just.
I gotcha.
I'm listing all three of them.
We do get all three of them in fairly quick succession.
For this iteration.
It's all contained in this prologue. It's a 3-day cycle wherein the empty man makes his presence known through increasingly brazen appearances.
Yes. First you hear him, then you see him, then you feel him, I think is the formulation we get much later on in the movie.
Yeah.
So day two has dawned, and the girl whose ear was whispered into ends up going outside and spotting this figure out in the blowing snow. And it's the empty man in his various appearances in this film looks more or less creepy at different times. For my money, this is when he looks the creepiest, because he's not quite pitch black, but he's, you know, contrasted against this swirling white blizzard. And also, he's got these sort of tattered rags blowing around.
Willowy, Dementor-esque.
Yeah, he's like a mummy Dementor. He's an unraveling mummy that is also a Dementor.
I thought he was pretty spooky when he was just an inky silhouette off in the distance. The closer he got, the less perturbed I was, partly because they do this thing where you hear his footfalls, and at first it's kind of sporadic, you know, thunk, thunk in the snow. Mm-hmm. And then dun, 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 as he picks up the pace, and he just looks like he shouldn't be using his feet to get around. Again, Dementor-esque, maybe more of a floating wraith kind of thing. If he was moving towards her noiselessly, that might have been scarier. I guess that they're trying to convey that he's picking up the pace. But I almost called him the bye-bye man. The empty man that I found the most formidable was actually just the inert, fossilized remains in the crevice.
Well, okay. I guess most of the time when we see him, he's in this sort of, and again, there are variations on this as I tried to get across, but he's basically like a Dementor, like it's sort of an empty hooded figure. And of all the versions of that iteration, yeah, I would say the, again, blowing mummy wrap.
Yeah, I'm with you there. This is the most eerie sighting outside of his,
but the cave
nest
is absolutely the worst, as in the most upsetting.
So she makes it inside. There's banging on the door, and then you hear, I don't remember her name, Clarissa, open up. And we think it's a trick, a ruse. She opens the door. In fact, her companions are on the doorstep.
Day three comes along, and there, going back across the bridge, and then Clarissa, I'll just use Matt's name for her, fucking snaps and repeatedly stabs the dude who was not the guy who fell in the crevice, repeatedly in the back. The one who
went to retrieve him.
Yeah. Yeah, and shoves him into the canyon, and then slits the other woman's throat, shoves her in, and then does a swan dive.
Kind of back pedals, yeah, into the abyss.
Herself. And that just leaves.
After locking eyes meaningfully with the ASMR incubus, who is left alone in the blizzard, and he starts blowing into a wind instrument, which she had also been toying with, I think, on night one.
Yeah, it's some kind of implement that is apparently responsible for summoning the bye-bye man. God damn it. The Bring empty man.
Don't say it, don't think
it. It's too fucking late. We're all gonna die. Fucking bye-bye man.
Charlie.
So, now we cut to, I forget the name of the town, but it's somewhere in Missouri,
mm-hmm.
in 2018, and we follow a security store owner slash ex-cop by the name of James LaSombra, which is a name that he says frequently and nonchalantly in a way that I remarked was impressive.
He says and does almost everything nonchalantly. It's kind of his most endearing characteristic. And we spend pretty much the entire movie in his company from here on out. Yeah. I don't think there's a scene without him in it.
Yeah, I think you're right.
He's a...
Well, no, I can think of one, but you're nearly right.
He's a stereotypical movie cop in that he has some tragedy in his recent history to do with a slain wife.
And son.
Dead family. Yeah.
Just dead family. He has a birthday lunch by himself at a Mexican restaurant,
mm-hmm.
has some coupon for a free meal, birthday meal, and then gets the saddest chain restaurant happy birthday celebration in the world. First of all, they don't know what his name is, so they say happy birthday, dear customer, in the chorus of the birthday song, and the hip hip hooray is very sad. It's all, again, it's the saddest iteration I've ever seen, and I've overheard plenty of those in various chain restaurants in all my years.
One thing I don't miss about eating out at restaurants. Mercifully, the scene cuts before we get the are you one, are you two?
Because the man is clearly in his mid-40s.
He is at home when he is, or is it her place? He's approached by the daughter of a neighbor, and she seems troubled. She's talking nonsensically about all manner of gibberish. You know, what if our thoughts originate somewhere else and we're just channeling them?
And nothing is real, and that means that I don't have to worry about anything because none of it matters.
And he says very matter-of-factly in his grizzled, I'm a cop with a dead wife voice, a lot of things are real. Which is hysterically funny.
It is. He doesn't sound that much like Batman. No, but otherwise,
he doesn't sound quite that much like Rorschach. I will grant you that, but I'm not far off.
You're not far off.
I'm closer with that than I was with the man in the pit.
And it is very funny.
The following morning, I guess, we get our day one drop again, like we did in the prologue, which prompted my co-host to exclaim, why? What did he do? Like, how, meaning, how has he incurred the wrath of the slender by man? It's like
the empty slender by man.
The girl he was just speaking to has gone missing. He goes over to her house, her bedroom, which is now a crime scene. Got actual still on duty cops poring over her desk and journal and such. There's a message in blood on the wall that says
mirror, I think.
The mirror, yes, that says the empty man made me do it. He gets a little bit of flack from some of the cops. One of them says, like, I heard about you, and that doesn't elaborate. It doesn't seem like there's any real animosity, but also no warm feelings. He goes through.
You used to be a cop, right? Yeah, I heard about you. And then the guy just wanders off.
He goes through. Missing girl's name is Amanda. He's going through Amanda's journal. He sees a leaflet of some kind for the Pontifex Institute. And written on the back is the word Tulpa. And as soon as I saw the word Tulpa, a flood of creepypasta memories came crashing over the dam I've built in my brain to keep all that shit quarantined.
and this flyer for the Pontifex Institute is something he finds in like four or five other places
over
the course of the next 20 to 25 minutes. The cops talk to both of them, him and Nora, Amanda's mother.
Yeah. Well, maybe you're my tulpa. We just said that in perfect unison.
Get the fuck out of here.
Or it could be yours. I mean, I'm not flip a coin for it.
Nah, I'm good. I don't want to break the illusion. So
right.
The cops are like, well, you know, she's 18. She's an adult. She took a suitcase. Well, she's in high school. There's a lot of this back and forth. And they're like, okay, well, we'll let you know if we figure anything out.
They're exactly as useless as movie cops always are in this scenario. And in real life, from what I hear much of the time.
Yeah, they beckon him outside to have a word out of her earshot. And then he comes back in and basically says, yeah, they're not going to do anything. They think the two of you just had a falling out.
Hey, so, there's blood on the damn mirror.
Right? So he agrees.
Just a run-of-the-mill runaway, obviously.
So he agrees to use his ex-cop skills to look into the matter himself. He
then proceeds to have an extremely busy 72 hours. We thought for sure...
Especially the first 24.
Yeah, we thought for sure that the movie had just dispensed with the day one, day two thing. Because day one stretches on so long, we thought for sure the sun had risen and fallen more than once. But no, he's just a very industrious ex-cop. He starts by going to Amanda's high school and grilling a friend of hers. We get a flashback where she relates this story of how a few days back, a bunch of them were hanging out on a bridge and they found an abandoned beer bottle and blew into it because there's this local superstition about the empty man and how when you're standing on a bridge at night and you blow into a bottle, you can summon the empty man. Day one, you hear him. Day two, you see him. Day three, he finds you.
Right. This girl is very nervous throughout, constantly looking around. Yeah,
she's on day two, if
right.
Memory serves.
And eventually she bails and runs off. He goes out to the bridge, doesn't really see much at first. He does come across what is presumably the bottle, or at least another bottle, kind of idly blows into it and then throws it in the river again. His nonchalance is his most endearing quality.
You aren't hurt anybody anymore. Get out of here.
Get off my bridge.
What was the movie we watched a couple episodes ago that ended with someone throwing something into a... Oh, it was Polaroid.
Oh, yeah, that was...
That's
yeah.
What I'm imagining. Chick disposing of the haunted Polaroid
camera. Yeah, except in that case...
No longer haunted Polaroid camera, I should say.
But in that case, we had the swelling superhero origin story... score going dum 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 dum.
Yeah, none of that this time.
No, thank God. He sees this manhole cover that's been lifted up, and crucially during the flashback scene we saw it seemed like an endless stream of teenagers just keep exiting from that one
just
by one,
clown carring out of it. So there's a bunch of them hanging out in the understructure of the bridge. So he descends through the manhole and is waving around the beam of his flashlight, and it falls upon a hanging corpse of a suicide, one of the teens,
and
he's not alone.
Yeah, no, he kind of cranes his head around and sees just a row of all these kids, and he's already, we elided this, but he's gone to all of their houses looking for them, and nobody knows where any of them are.
Yeah.
And now they do. Also, once again, written in what looks like potentially dried blood on one of the girders is "The empty man made me do it."
In case there was any doubt.
Right.
So he alerts the cops. Needless to say, next time we see the bridge, the sun has gone down and there's cop lights flashing. Meanwhile, the girl he spoke to earlier is showering in a spa, I think, or like a gym locker room.
I don't think she's showering. I'm pretty sure she's... it's a like a sauna
okay
situation. She's
it looks communal and fancy, so I wasn't quite sure what I was looking at.
Yeah, so she's having a schwitz basically, and the steam is very thick. We're held in suspense for quite some time, and then the empty man appears and starts stabbing her in the face with a pair of scissors. Next thing we know, there's a cut and she is holding herself up by the neck and using her other hand to stab herself in the face. And eventually she falls to the ground dead.
Run-of-the-mill suicide. Just like a man's run-of-the-mill disappearance.
And next thing we know, James is talking to the same detective who showed up at Amanda's house earlier and talking about all of the deaths. This is when James finds out that the girl died in the sauna. And then he's back at his house and he gets a call from Nora. All of this, again, has happened in the same day.
Day
one.
You
can understand why we were befuddled.
Yes.
So she comes in and she's very clearly distraught. She's brought like Chinese food. He consoles her, and then it kind of turns potentially more intimate than that. We get the sense that something has transpired between them romantically, yeah, or at least sexually.
History there, and seems like she's more keen to rekindle it than he is.
This more or less ends with her just kind of leaving. And then he has this creepy encounter with the bye-bye man. I'm just going to keep calling him that. That's what my mouth wants to say every time. With the empty man just being heard tromping around in his bedroom hallway, like outside his bedroom. And not for the last time, he has woken up at 3:03 in the morning, just before it turns to 3:04. We see the clock every time this happens. And yeah, he has a near miss with the empty man.
You don't get to a 2-hour and 17-minute runtime without lingering on a lot of incidental details like that.
Yes.
So finally, we have arrived at day two. This is when the Trojan horse begins to open and the movie becomes increasingly less and less about the Slenderman. So he is looking into the Pontifex Institute. He goes to some kind of Scientology center, basically. He's given a questionnaire by the creepy lady at the front desk. It's funny, I've in years past taken mental health diagnostics here and there, you know, personality assessment, depression, ADD, long time ago, who knows what else. I know, but it's not worth getting into. Nothing too crazy, I assure you. It's funny, tests like that always throw a couple curveball questions at you. You'll get a couple inane ones. It'll be something like, I don't always sleep that well at night. You know, I don't always wake up feeling fully rested. I get self-conscious when I have to deliver a speech in public. Sneaky people are trying to take credit for my accomplishments. I remember that one verbatim. Sneaky people are trying to take credit for my accomplishments. Because I just thought, like, what do they think I am, Travis Bickle? Like,
pretty great.
And they think they're so fucking sneaky. Now I do sound paranoid because they just, it's one in every 10 or so that they'll just hit you with a, but this
questionnaire is 10 out of 10. All of them are weird as
11
shit.
Out of 10. Yeah, no, they're all sneaky people style questions. You know, not all shadows are cast by a physical object. If science says the sky is blue, then it's probably red.
The scientific method is a tool of oppression. That's verbatim.
And on and on and on.
So he, again, like, what the fuck is this shit? Again, his endearing, no-nonsense attitude.
Mm-hmm.
He can't get a straight answer from the lady at the front desk. Go fucking figure. He eventually tosses the clipboard aside and follows a line of people into an auditorium where Stephen Root is giving a motivational speech about the empty man and about how, I say it's about the empty man. He doesn't invoke that phrase until the closing line.
Yeah, we got to wade through a lot of gobbledygook first about how there's no such thing as loss and the present is the past and what have you.
People are obsessed with getting more and taking up more space when we should think about getting rid of things and taking up less space, etc., etc. And he ends with saying we should all strive to become the empty man or something to that effect. Then James kind of sidles over to him after he has concluded his speech and is mingling. We get this, in lesser hands, it would be just this heinous, expository, droning monologue, but instead, it's delightful. It's just like him pontificating about anything and everything. The delivery sells it, at least for me. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, with Stephen Root, he's going to inject some personality into it. It was kind of more of the same. I mean, he's no longer on stage, but it's still the same spiel. A very free-ranging, pseudo-philosophical woo kind of series of digressions.
All this culminates in him saying, like, I'm glad you came back. Stay longer next time. I've never been here before. Just walks away. Again, he seems unruffled by that. He's just like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. You're out of your gourd.
He's not wrong.
True.
is wrong about many things, we'll come to learn, including lots of things are real. It's actually a misstatement on his part, we come to find.
I would like to note that at this time I said...
Yeah, let the record show.
Let the record show. And I said out loud, God, I would love to have this turn out to be a fucking Shutter Island situation where he's actually been here like 12 times and just forgotten every time.
From your mouth to God's ears. He bumps into this 20-something kid in an alleyway outside who starts talking to him. Like, you almost expect to hear like someone strumming a cello in the background. He sounds like he's in a beatnik coffee shop.
Upright bass. Yeah, the boom, 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 boom.
Hey, man.
I mean, the fucking... James makes a crack about him doing a David Cassidy routine, which was pretty good.
It's like, yo, these cats, man, can you dig it?
And so on.
These cats are far out. They're outer rim, man. You know, I'm kind of making him sound like Tommy Chong right now, but it's not exactly right.
Yeah, the one line in this sequence that I liked is when he said, you don't want to mess with these guys. They don't have 5-year plans. They have 500-year plans. That was kind of far out in a way that worked for me.
Yeah.
So he gives him a lead, which James proceeds to track down. He finds an abandoned property once used by the cult.
Which we have seen in his earlier researches into the Pontifex Institute. Very gratifyingly, his internet searches are not riddled with websites that don't actually exist. The worst one, was it in Ouija, maybe?
I think it was Ouija, the first Ouija.
The protagonist in Ouija goes to a website that is just called Search.
No, James uses what
Google
is recognizably Google and Wikipedia.
Yeah, he uses Google and reads Wikipedia. And one of the things first, we see that the cult was in Bhutan, and then it moved to the States, and here's this cabin, and so we've seen a picture of this cabin before, and now he's there in the flesh.
At this abandoned property, he finds a file cabinet containing a file with his name on it. The file is empty. There are other files with the names of Amanda and all the other usual suspects, all the other kids who offed themselves under the bridge. He then finds a cabin, very dusty, dilapidated cabin, with a tattered teddy bear on the floor, a good, like, knee-height teddy bear, and an old CRT television with a VCR hooked up to it. He plugs in a VHS tape labeled...
Manifestation B, or something
I think it was Manifestation 13, but Manifestation something or other.
Yeah, I mean, the number or letter doesn't
handwriting.
Really
matter. And he watches some kind of Tulpa experiment, chanting. It's, you know, from some time ago when the cult was more Manson-y than L. Ron Hubbard.
You know what it...
More grassroots.
You know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of the, like, home videos of the cult in the lodge.
Okay, I can see that.
And I would go into more length about that or perhaps save it for recommendations, but we've already done the lodge in a podcast
episode. Yeah, we can direct you to episode number whatever.
23 or somewhere in that range, I think.
Christ, it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
The Lodge is a movie about losing track of time in large part, so it's funny that I would have... It's an eerie movie to have that feeling about, but that's 2020 in a nutshell, 2021 now.
It's still 2020. It's all the same.
There's this sort of hairless, slippery-looking humanoid thing in the video. Maybe a tulpa of some kind. It looks like it's not fully put together.
It's got glowing eyes.
Yeah, which might just be glare of some kind, but it locks eyes with the camera. And therefore with James, and then the footage cuts out. In the footage, grainy VHS footage, we see it painting on the wall. James turns to his right, sees the painting. So, okay, it was filmed on the premises.
Also, I don't want to say crucially, because it really doesn't come to anything, but worth noting is there is a cut at one point during him watching the video to the teddy bear sitting on the ground, and it moves a little bit.
Ever so slightly.
Yeah.
It sounds hack, but it's done. It's so blink and you miss it. I mean, it might literally be a matter of 1 to 3 frames. It's, you know, I hesitate to use the word subliminal, because if you can detect it with your eyes, it's not properly subliminal, but it's really a borderline case.
Yeah.
A lot of people would not have caught it, I'd wager. I'm endeavoring to prove that I'm an attentive viewer after last episode's flub. mine. I hasten to add, not my co-hosts. Oh, and the painting on the wall also very strongly resembles the space jockey remains from the gorge in Bhutan. He goes outside, sees a raging fire that, like Ten Commandments style, turns into a pillar of flame. The stars kind of start bleeding smearing together.
Yeah.
So he's losing it a little bit. And there's a bunch of people, dark figures, robed figures, arrayed around this fire, who all take notice of him at the same time and start moving in eerie unison.
Well, it's like a staged process. First, it cuts back to him after he kind of spaces out and there's no like light dancing on his face. So at first I thought that everybody got teleported into the sky, but instead he looks back and the fire's just out and they're all standing in a clump, and then they started like marching away, and then yeah, they take notice of him and start menacing him. He takes a step back. They all en masse take a step forward. He does it again. They do it again. And then he says, what exactly is it? He says
something like, okay, fuck this. In his usual blasé way.
He's like, no, we're not doing this. And he just turns around and hauls ass back to his car.
They follow suit, pick up the pace. They start trying to demolish his vehicle.
Yeah, it's the group of people chasing after him is a cross in my mind between Kill List,
mm-hmm.
being chased by the cultists, and then a Slenderman web series called Tribe 12, where the protagonist, and also the protagonists from another web series.
Yeah, you want to talk about creepypasta cross-pollination. A lot of the non-Marble Hornets series, basically all of them, to my memory, involved cults in some capacity.
Right, and in fact, Tribe 12 basically hijacked the cult from this other web series and then got the best
front row seat
footage out of it, basically.
Yeah, it was extremely funny. One of the diamonds in the rough. There was a lot of rough.
There's a lot of rough in that one. That's very true. But anyway, yeah, again, cultists all chasing him out of a forest and chasing after him when he's like backing away.
Well, as if seeing the word Tulpa written down wasn't enough, the dam has well and truly broken now that we've brought Tribe 12 into this. It's really taken me back. So he goes to give a statement to the police. They kind of want nothing to do with his bullshit. They worry that he's jeopardized their investigation. So he gives them a written statement, goes to bed, and it's an escalation from the previous night. He now both sees and hears the bye-bye man. And then we have day three. Day three is upon us.
Right.
At long last.
The following sequence of events might be slightly out of order, but the order isn't especially relevant really until the end, so I don't think it matters. At some point, he gets a hold of Nora and says, we gotta go. She gets a phone call on her landline, hands it to him, more ASMR incubus noises. It's like, yeah, we gotta go. We gotta get the hell out of here.
Yeah.
Takes her to a hotel and leaves her there. Call me if you have any problems.
That was all still night, too. You're right.
Okay.
Also, the teddy bear, aforementioned teddy bear, shows up on his doorstep.
Yeah. And the next day, he's driving around with it.
In his back seat, like driving Miss Daisy.
He's tailing the David Cassidy guy, who is in this car, like a clown car. Uh-huh. People just keep piling into it to the point where it's like nearly dragging on the pavement as it's driving. Like, whenever they hit a bump, there are sparks. Eventually, they get to a hospital where they all pile out. He tails them inside, up some stairs, all the way to the ICU, where there's this guy, looks to be in a coma. He resembles Paul, the dude from the prologue who became the ASMR incubus, and it turns out later that that's exactly who it is. They have kind of a worshipy sort of moment, you know, mm-hmm. they fall to their knees around him.
It's like the presentation of baby Simba. They just all hit the deck.
Yeah. He tails them back out, they disperse, and the last to get out of the car is David Cassidy.
Boom, boom, boom.
He kidnaps this guy.
Yeah, he harshes his mellow. He zaps him in the face with pepper spray, throws him in his back seat, cuffs him, I think.
Yeah.
Basically, on the assumption correct, I think we're meant to believe that he set him up, that he, yes, like sent him to that semi-abandoned compound to be killed or abducted.
Right, and this is more or less immediately confirmed. They get off into some kind of, like, train yard or industrial park or something, and James throws him out of the car and starts interrogating him, and it's more of the same, like, nothing is real. We're just a conduit for thoughts that are not our own. I forget what they call it, like the no-sphere or something. It's like the atmosphere, but for thoughts.
Yeah, his spiel is a lot less endearing than Steven Root's, I have to say. He just sounds like he's on something. It's not invested with much in the way of real menace.
Right.
And he does the kind of Joker interrogation thing where James starts punching him and he's just cackling through the blows.
And the blood running down his face, yeah. Eventually, James just sees that he's not going to get anything more out of this. And
somehow
he lays his hands on that red file folder that had his name on it. But this time, it's just chock full of personal information.
It's gone from being a folder with nothing in it to a folder with everything in it. I mean, clippings about him going back to his infancy and photographs of his wife and child.
And growing up in San Francisco, which is something he has said about himself
repeatedly,
three separate times.
Like a parrot. And most amusingly, but also kind of most ominously, the free meal clipping, the coupon that he used at the Mexican restaurant.
Is in there, yeah. So he goes back to the hospital and goes to the nurse's station. The nurse is relatively inattentive, at least at first. He says, like, yeah, my name's James LaSombra. You know, I'm a private investigator. He, like, flips open his wallet idly. There's clearly, like, no PI license in there or anything. But she's also not looking. He closes it, puts it away again. That's just him to a T. He's trying to get some information about this guy in the ICU. At first, she's taking the traditional, like, well, I can't divulge patient information line. And then
she becomes much more loquacious, basically
almost
at the drop of a hat.
Yeah. We eventually find out, he's been here for 2 years, but he's been, like, catatonic for 23. Oh, count that back. What year was that?
Right. Let me crunch the numbers real quick. So they've been moving him around from ICU to ICU. James wants to know who's footing the bill. Obviously, it's the cult.
Right. She says something about he gets a lot of visitors. He has one right now. And we have an idea at this point who it is. And sure enough, it's Amanda. And
she's shaving him, trimming his beard.
James goes in there and starts asking her questions. What are you going to do? I got to call your mom. And this is when it gets spooky. He calls Nora and says, hi, it's James. Who? She just has no idea what or who he's talking about.
Yeah, you have the wrong number.
Repeatedly. And then hangs up and he's just flabbergasted. And this is when we find out that the empty man is not the Tulpa, at least not the figure that we've been seeing. The Tulpa is James.
He is the empty man.
Amanda and her cohorts have conjured him.
Yeah, he's empty in the sense that he's a vacuity. He's a vessel that was prepared by the cult 3 days ago. He's been alive for all of 72 hours, and he's going to be a vessel, like I said, for the demon, whatever you want to call it, to occupy now that it has run its old host ragged. A normal human can't harbor it for that long, apparently. So they had to make one from scratch.
Because otherwise they would have had to wait 500 years for another vessel to turn up.
Or for someone else to stumble into the pit in Bhutan, maybe.
Right.
Who knows?
So they didn't want to wait that long, so they conjured him. He has a several scenes long breakdown, basically. He rattles through his flashbacks of his family and how they died and how also Nora's husband died, and at the funeral or after the funeral, the two of them had sex, and that's when his family died. It's just everything. And meanwhile, he's wigging out on the floor of the ICU. And she's just telling him to let go, how much easier it would be.
And then he's being pursued through the, and we didn't touch on this, when he visits the Scientology Center, he goes into kind of the underbelly of the building and sees some kind of circle, some kind of conference in the shadows, and is escorted out by security. He's being chased through that environment now, this dimly lit boiler room kind of setting, by the Bye-Bye Man.
There's this little set piece feature to that whereby in the initial iteration he's up on a catwalk and he can hear a noise from the lower floor. At first, he thinks he's made the noise, and they're calling out to him, like, we can hear you. But he's like, oh, it's something else, some other figure. Is it the empty man? As we find out, it was also him.
Uh-huh.
That's what's going on in the climax sequence.
Sort of a more successful variant of the trope that we were talking about in the You Should Have Left episode.
Mm-hmm.
Where you get into there were two, I almost called him Ethan Hawke, fuck me. There are two Kevin Bacons in the room, unbeknownst to us the whole time, that kind of thing.
Every horror movie about a writer is sinister. anyway, James is fleeing the creature, which is less Dementor-like now, has more substance to it, seemingly. It's more squicky, alien, monstery sort of.
Yeah, tentacular.
It eventually catches up to him and forces its entire essence down his throat.
Mm-hmm.
And then he stumbles through a series of corridors which lead back into the ICU room. He executes the comatose guy, wanders out, and gets the same treatment from everyone who's in the next room, the falling to the knees bit.
The kneeling, yeah. Bowing and supplication. There you have it.
And that's the movie. So we'll go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with plenty of thoughts afterwards.
Hey, wait. We gotta try it.
Try what?
Calling the empty man.
Who's the empty man?
If you're on a bridge and you find a bottle, you blow into it, and you think about the empty man. Oh, come on, Mandy. How old are you?
Tell him the rest.
On the first night, you hear him. And on the second night, you see him.
And on the third night?
Well, on the third night, he finds you.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
He finds you. You can hear him, can't you? Squirming his way into your thoughts. Like a disease. And his message is contagious.
And we're back. So, I guess, just in the interest of not burying the lead, this movie is kind of a mess, and I kind of liked it anyway. I don't know how you felt about it, but that's the upshot.
I did like it. I think you liked it more than I did, but I did not dislike it by any means. I have some beef with it, which I will get into, obviously. But, yeah, it's not... I called it a Trojan horse for a reason. I mean, it was sort of a pleasant surprise to realize that I wasn't just going to watch a nearly 2.5 hour long Bye Bye Man, because that's hell.
We would just have been in hell.
So it's not that. And I don't know. Once it shifts gears and becomes more about the cult, it started to grab me. I think it could have done more with that pivot, though. And some of the front-loaded boogeyman business falls by the wayside kind of too quickly and too inelegantly for my liking. I mean, the stuff with blowing into the bottles, you know, and all of the ritualistic, folkloric that stuff doesn't have any real resonance, and it feels like it is just there as obfuscation, and I think that's kind of a missed opportunity. I mean, you've got the whistle or the wind instrument, whatever it is, in the prologue, so the bottle stuff is echoing that, so it's not totally superfluous or totally arbitrary, but it really does just vanish from the movie.
I don't want the following to sound like I thought this movie was so great that I couldn't get enough of it and I demand more of it. That being said, there's so much going on in this movie, and it shifts gears so completely from one thing to another, as you've said, that I think it almost would have worked better as a mini-series than a film. I could have done
with a feature-length prologue, frankly. The stuff in the cabin was maybe the highlight of the movie for me.
Which is weird, because we just finished saying that we didn't want a feature, like a 2.5 hour Bye Bye Man. But
at least then the snowy Bhutan in 1995, the setting is novel, if nothing else.
Well, yeah.
It reminded me of that movie, The Ritual, from a few years ago. Again, about hikers running afoul of a creepypasta, basically.
Yeah, but I think you're absolutely right. The setting and just the execution of, the prologue. The scene in the cave is probably the highlight of the whole movie. Just that setting is terrifying.
In terms of the spook factor, yeah.
Yeah, and him whispering, again, almost inaudibly, if you touch me, you're going to die. That's spooky. That's fucking spooky.
Yeah, I could have done with like a 50-minute episode set in Bhutan in the 90s and then a 5 or 6 episode run about ex-detective James doing his true detective or his sharp objects business.
Yeah, you know, you get like maybe 2 episodes where we think it's a Bloody Mary sort of summon the boogeyman kind of thing, and then it kind of transitions into the cult thing, and that plays out over 3 or 4 episodes. So yeah, I think, again, I liked this movie rather more than I would have thought, both going in and just thinking about it during with how jumbled it is. I don't like it that much that I'm clamoring for a miniseries, but I think it might have worked better that
way.
It
is completely out of character for me to look at a movie and say, like, that should have been a miniseries or a TV show. You know, I'm not a TV guy. By and large, Jim has watched oodles and oodles more television than I have. It's not even close. So it is, I think, saying something that I'm seconding that take.
Yeah. As it stands, though, again, I've said it's kind of a jumble, and I think that's a fair assessment, because it's like they're driving a car with manual gear shift, and then not only are they shifting gears, but they manage to skip a gear. You know, it's kind of an awkward jump from, okay, we've basically got a Bye Bye Man style boogeyman who is worming his way into teenagers' brains and getting them to kill themselves, into there's this Scientology-esque doomsday cult that is summoning tulpas and channeling cosmic evil.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, the various parts don't necessarily sit easily with one another.
I could have done with more Steven Root, which surely would have happened in a miniseries format.
Right.
This is based on a graphic novel, apparently. I don't know if it's like a singular text or whether it was more of like a series that was then
retroactively gathered into.
It's paced more like the latter, and that's just a supposition on my part. But if they'd made like a miniseries that had respected that format more, we probably would have gotten, would have had more room for Steven Root to spread his wings and fly. I think his bit, and you were more taken with it than I was, although I still enjoyed it. There's something about the charisma of cult leaders where they can be saying a bunch of hot nonsense, but in a way that's convivial enough or kind of compelling enough that you feel yourself getting suckered in by it. And he had a little bit of that cadence, Steven Root did. Not as much as, I don't know the guy who plays the Jim Jones wannabe in The Sacrament, but that guy was like really magnetic. He's kind of the poster child for what I'm describing.
Yeah.
In my mind, at least in recent horror films. It was that movie from like 2013 or so?
Yeah, that sounds right.
I had issues with The Sacrament only because the body count wasn't high enough for my liking. I mean, Jonestown is almost 1,000 people died in that movie.
Enormous massacre.
In that movie, it was a few dozen, and that was just budgetary, it seems to me. So that kind of took me out of it. But he was great. And Steven Root has a little bit of that cult leader charisma to him. And I think that the cult was most credible and compelling when he was on screen, and unfortunately it's basically a glorified cameo appearance. I mean, he shows up and then a few minutes later he goes away, never to be seen again.
Yeah, just the one scene, probably like a one day walk on walk off shoot sort of thing for him.
Mm-hmm.
Pop in, make his speeches, collect a paycheck, etc. Yeah, I agree with you. I could have done with more of him. I usually can, so
sure,
that is what it is. But also in this particular context, just from the character, I could have used more of that. One thing I don't like about the climax is after he discovers, well, not discovers, it's just announced to him, that after it's revealed to him that he is a tulpa, he is an empty man, he is a shell that has been conjured up over the course of 3 days, and he's having his breakdown, the way he cycles through all of the apparently false memories in greater detail and at greater length than we have seen them to this point.
After we've learned that none of it ever happened.
Right.
It robs it of its impact that it's clearly intended to have.
There's this weird emphasis on all of it, almost to the point where the movie couldn't quite commit to the idea that it was all bullshit.
And I get that it's not bullshit for him, but we're still putting the cart before the horse here. I mean, the rug has been pulled out from under us, and he's still agonizing over, like, oh no, my wife and child had that car accident the night that I was cheating on her. And we've only seen it in snippets before. I mean, this is the first time we see the car going off a bridge and into a river. And with all the bridge imagery in this movie, especially the first act or so, you'd think that would be a theme that should have emerged earlier.
We never see the going off the bridge thing until right here. Far be it for me to say you have to do X thing the same way every time, but there's a reason why this sort of reveal is done in the following way, that at the climax, the character gets the first inkling that their understanding of events is wrong, and then they start cycling through all of these flashbacks and whatever else, and throughout that keeps drip feeding. And then at the end of this whole final rundown, that's when they have the revelation. There's a reason it's done that way every time. That's because that's how it works best.
Yeah, it's weird. It's like, oh, you invoked Shutter Island. It's an apt comparison, and you just intuited that at around the midway point. In Shutter Island, the epiphany that hits Leonardo DiCaprio, I mean, his eyes are opened. The wife and son going off the bridge is framed in this movie like the tragedy in DiCaprio's past in Shutter Island. Only in Shutter Island, he's remembering buried trauma, whereas here, he's remembering a fabrication.
But he's remembering that it's not real.
But the movie is positing, I mean, it's contextualized as though this is the epiphany when it's the smokescreen. It's the opposite of the truth. It is very puzzling. I think the all-time biggest blunder of this kind, and it's a movie that I have some affection for, Identity, whodunit. With Ray Liotta and an ensemble cast, John Cusack. It's a murder mystery in a motel, roadside motel on a rainy night. The characters are getting picked off one by one. And one of them is a cop played by Ray Liotta. And there's a scene early in the movie where you see him disrobing in his motel room. And there's a big blood stain on the back of his shirt, but he does not appear to be wounded. And that's an intriguing mystery, you know? And then we find out partway through the movie, around 2/3 of the way through the movie, that all of these characters who have been getting picked off one by one are alternate personalities in the mind of a inmate of a psych ward with multiple personality disorder. And one of his personalities is murderous, and the doctors don't know which. And so that personality is killing off all the other personalities in this mindscape motel in his brain.
This mind motel as opposed to mind palace.
Some of us have palaces between our ears. Some of us have the Holiday Inns, I guess. Anyway, after that bombshell, we then get the reveal that Ray Liotta's character murdered a cop and is impersonating him. And it's like, who gives a rat's ass?
He's not real.
He's not real, and neither was the cop. None of these assholes are real. This motel doesn't exist. And like that's idiotic. And when I was watching the end of The Empty Man, that's where my mind went right away. It's like trying to divide by zero. It just makes my mind sputter out. I don't know why. It's so harebrained. It makes no sense to me.
Yeah. Again, as Matt prefaced that by saying, that reveal and Identity is dumber than how this climax is executed.
And the problem is that in Identity, those are both good reveals, you know, for the kind of movie it is. they're just in the wrong order. Like, right. I like Ray Liotta's arc in that movie where you think he's a cop and then find out that he's a hood
he,
on
he
the
killed
lam.
Killed the cop.
Yeah, right. But it's cart before the horse, like I said.
And yeah, to a certain extent, it's basically the same thing here. And lo and behold, it doesn't work either time.
Yeah. I have to say, James, ex-Detective James, has a conspicuous amount of personality for someone who's supposed to be a blank slate and an empty cavity. He's very blasé and flippant throughout the whole movie. Like we said, my favorite bit, and this got a laugh out of you, I remember, when he's like getting coffee after Stephen Root's speech, he goes up to one of the cultists and is like, you know...
Well, it's David Cassidy.
Is it? Okay, yeah. I thought it might have been. But this is before they rendezvous in the alley. He shows him Amanda's picture, I think, and says, you ever see her hanging out around here? And the guy shrugs and wanders off. Doesn't say a word, just, and off he goes. And then James goes, liar. After his back's turned, you know, he just, you know, him constantly talking. The San Francisco thing is actually a little bit clever because it's the kind of thing that a tulpa would say when they only have X number, like a very finite number of things programmed into them. He's like an automaton in that respect.
That reminds me of a particular movie, and I'll be goddamned if I can remember what it is.
Some of it reminded me of the weird tick that Tom Cruise has in Eyes Wide Shut, where he keeps saying, you can trust me, I'm a doctor, but just to everyone, in order to endear himself to this waitress or that security guard or that proprietor of a costume shop or... who knows what else. He just says it over and over again. Well, because it's a status thing, and it makes sense thematically in Eyes Wide Shut for him to be doing that. But that's where my mind went. But I feel like there are better examples that are on the tip of my tongue.
Yeah, there's some movie, or maybe more than one, where there's a character who is not who they think they are, and they keep, like, they have stock phrases that they keep repeating.
One of them, and I haven't seen it in many years, one of them might be the recommendation that I've got on the back burner, so I'll save that for the time being.
Okay, well, we'll see if that gives me an epiphany when you drop that. I hope it does, because this is going to keep me awake.
Empty
tonight.
Man-style epiphany, where your whole life unravels.
But, yeah, I mean, I enjoy James as a character. The actor is also named James. He's James Badge Dale. He's kind of a that guy. He was henchman in Iron Man 3, you know, one of the like,
super-powered goons.
Super-powered fire goons.
I seem to remember him in that movie, yeah.
He was in, like, the third season of 24. He was in this movie called The Standoff at Sparrow Creek.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah, he was, like, the main dude in that.
I trust you. I mean, that movie is kind of dimly lit.
Fair enough. I think, actually, yeah, no, fucking the David Cassidy guy was also in that movie.
Okay, that I buy. I see, yes, okay.
He was...
kind of squirrely
he
motherfucker.
He was the traitor, mealy-mouthed kind of guy. Spoilers for Standoff at Sparrow Creek. But anyway, so James Badge Dale, he's good in this movie. Again, I just very much enjoy his character's affect throughout. Just the sort of, like, I keep... using the word nonchalance. I think I picked that up from your description earlier on, but it's just, you know, he's like cool in the classic sense of the term.
In a way that's
not over the top.
It risks being really tropey and kind of is, but the fact that he was written into existence helps to justify that to a certain extent, and his very by-the-numbers dead wife trauma.
Right.
You know, he's like the protagonist of a Christopher Nolan movie. Or something. It is tropey, and that's probably, I mean, and Amanda even lampshades that when she's giving him the whole rundown. She says that the host body has to be a fearful creature. It needs to be guilty and afraid in order for the demon that they worship to slither into it and take root.
But even before we get that reveal, which, as you say, does kind of make apologies after the fact for the tropiness, the other thing that kind of sells it for me is that, as a character, the script doesn't take him too seriously, if that makes sense. It's not like...
It's not like try-hard edgelord.
You know, he's a cop. Yeah. You know, it's just, he's a dude, and he's doing a thing.
And he's kind of goofy. He's a bit of a cut up, but not like a class clown. He's just kind of, he keeps bringing up San Francisco, I think at least two out of the three times that it comes up, because he's trying to impress upon the cultists that he is open-minded about hippy-dippy shit.
Right.
West Coast, man. That kind of thing. So he's got a sense of humor, which goes along like this. Could have been a real slog without some of that energy at 2 hours and 17 minutes.
Right. So yeah, I mean, I like that performance and I like that character. Like we said, Steven Root's fun. Beyond that, the characters and the performances aren't so important. That's really not what this movie is about. I don't know. You might feel differently, but I think that's more or less the case.
We're on the same page there. And what I'm about to say is a little bit, it runs counter to what I was just saying about liking the main dude's performance, because obviously to have that kind of performance, you need straight men to play off of. But I think I prefer movies like this and twists like this when they play fair, like Bruce Willis in Sixth Sense. Every time he talks to his wife, she never responds.
Mm-hmm.
So then when the "he was dead the whole time" twist is dumped in your lap, you're, you know, oh no, it like all comes together for you as it's coming together for him. Whereas when you watch The Empty Man or a lot of movies like this that don't play fair completely, instead of feeling the shock viscerally, you instead think, okay, so this happened, but that didn't. You're like running through an inventory thinking like, okay, this is what I now have to discount based on this new information. Whereas in Sixth Sense, there's nothing that you have to jettison from your brain. It all happened exactly the way it played out. But it was misleading in a more artful, kind of subtle way.
Yeah,
if that distinction makes sense.
The biggest lingering question here vis-a-vis him is like,
so all the scenes with Nora definitely never happened.
Well, either they never happened or she was in on the conspiracy. It's one or the other.
Okay. Well, and the cop who claims to have heard of him cannot have said that, because he would not, or he was also in on the conspiracy, possibly.
Or that's just a cop thing to say, like, oh yeah, you know, I heard of you, or whatever.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
The other thing that was weird, you know, in the folder, there was like a news clipping, like, ex-cop opens store or whatever, and I could have sworn the picture of the dude that was in that clipping was not him. And it made me think that they were, like, basing this Tulpa off of a real guy.
Yeah, or probably bits and pieces of multiple real guys.
And if that's the case, then maybe random snarky comment cop had heard of the real life guy.
Could be.
And then imputed it onto this Tulpa.
Again, mini-series format. Answer some of these questions, possibly.
But anyway, yeah, circling back around to Nora, conceivably, if she was in on all of this, her dropping the bombshell on him when he calls her from the ICU, like, who is this? I don't know anybody by that name. You have a wrong number. This was calculated to help his final...
to shell shock him.
Fracturing.
That I would have liked if that had been... I mean, normally I'm all in favor of ambiguity, but I feel like that's a moment where you want to...
you want to drive that home a little more.
You want to feel the snare tightening.
Yeah. You want to get maybe just a little bit more, because I get the feeling that if I watch through this movie again with that concept in mind and like closely watching Nora and that character, I'm not going to come away with it like, oh yeah, here's where I should have picked that up. There's not going to be anything like that.
Yeah, no, I don't think this movie is going to really yield riches upon a second or third viewing. I think what you see is more or less what you get.
But yeah, going back to your initial contention, it's also entirely possible that these scenes were imagined on his part, because really, I mean, anything
prior to the Mexican restaurant was. Presumably he remembers that just as vividly as he does talking to the cops or talking to Nora or the Mexican restaurant, for that matter.
Right. Well, and just because he was created before the Mexican restaurant, he could have imagined things that had happened since.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, there's nothing... any scene, and this honestly at the end of the day is kind of annoying, because, you know, it's just,
we rail against this all the time when subjective horror movies are too wishy-washy
and
did or didn't happen,
and there's nothing to ground yourself on.
Yeah.
But it's not interesting.
Yeah, there's no solid land in sight. You're just out to fucking see.
And yeah, so theoretically, looking back on this, any one of those scenes could have been imagined. And also, that makes you wonder, okay, if he's not real and if he needed to be a vessel. Why did he get chased by the cult? Was this all just part of the process of frazzling him
right
to the breaking point?
So you brought up Kill List earlier. A lot of stuff happens in Kill List that is basically unaccountable, except that it has ritualistic significance for some kind for the cultists, who are the ones pulling the strings. And the viewer, like the protagonist, is in the dark about what this means or what that means or why it has to all play out a certain way. A lot of my favorite cult horror movies,
which is to say horror movies about cults.
About cults, in every sense.
Right.
Operate that way. Wicker Man works that way. I talked about this in more than one review at this point, I think. It doesn't matter if you know why they're doing it. If you can look at a cult ritual and just feel like they know what they're all about, then it's scary because you're not part of the in-group and you worry that they have ill intent, as they so often do in movies like this. The cult in this movie is a little too Tribe 12, a little too watered down Scientology to give me a really potent sense of that sort of cult horror thing, but it gets halfway there. And, I'm a sucker for that kind of stuff, so I'm willing to cut a movie a lot of slack if it's even got a halfway decent cult in it.
Right.
Take what I can get.
Yeah, I think the interpretation of the movie that gives it the most credit and therefore allows me to derive the most enjoyment is that everything that has happened to him subsequent to his creation, I guess, was part of the process of breaking down what they had built in order to allow the demon in,
mm-hmm.
basically. So going through the weird Scientology place and having all these weird interactions, getting nearly murdered by this cult, and subsequently, at the climax, having Nora pull out the rug from under him. I think in order to take as much satisfaction from this movie as possible, I'm going to decide to believe that's what happened.
And the movie is allowing you to do that.
It's plausible.
Yeah,
yeah,
plausible enough. It's plausible as any of the other interpretations.
Right. Before we get to our recommendations, one other thing that I'd like to touch on, which may seem a little esoteric, but I really liked the color grading in this movie, which is, I think, unusual for horror movies of this caliber. And I know that sounds like a dig, because it kind of is, but like, horror movies that are made for $5 to $7 million and are not an A24 picture, that are just like meant to be arty and therefore have to be beautiful, just kind of a stock run-of-the-mill horror movie, the colors are for shit. Like they always just look drab, and why are we even looking at this? But a lot of the time, the color in this movie is actually rather striking. I don't know if you got this at all. And when I say striking, I don't mean like in a Argento Suspiria sense where it's just blowing up with Technicolor. Well, but I mean just like very, I don't know.
That's the route that a lot of other middle-of-the-road horror movies go these days. They just go all in on the neon in like an 80s nostalgia pandering kind of way, which I'm largely over at this point.
Yeah.
That was a big feature of The Gallows Act 2, I think.
Yeah.
Most recently. Yeah. But a bunch of horror movies that we've watched, some for the podcast, others not. This movie has none of that. But yeah, it was, I said in our review, I think, of Polaroid, that some pretty lousy horror movies these days are relatively easy on the eyes. The turds are more polished in 2020, say, than they were 10 years ago or 20 years ago. But I think that Empty Man, even by that standard, is
a cut above.
Appealing, yeah.
Yeah, visually. That's basically what I was going to get to. Like, yeah, I agree that even though Polaroid, by and large, is crap, it's better looking than crap would have been 15 years ago. But again, Empty Man is even a little bit better than that, because Polaroid, as much as it more or less looks good, again, it's kind of drab, colors are very bland, and it's, in that sense, nothing much to look at. But one scene in particular, I think, conveys this for me. It's the scene on the bridge, the flashback scene with all the kids and the initial summoning.
And the beer bottle, yeah.
And that's just, it's the right amount of light and the faded blue of the bridge. And it, you know, it all, it's a much better looking movie than it has any right to be, I guess is my point. And I don't think that's true for 100% of the movie, but it's true for large chunks of it, I think.
Yeah, I liked the deep blacks and the yellow, kind of sickly looking yellow lighting in the subterranean complex that mm-hmm. he finds himself in periodically. That was pulled off rather well.
And even just like some of the early scenes where he's going around doing his detective thing, like the scene when he's on the bridge in daylight before he goes underneath and finds all the kids strung up having hung themselves. That looks way better than it has any right to.
Yeah, the whole Bhutan sequence. I mean, we started this movie getting into it thinking, all right, here we go. A 2 hour, 17 minute Slenderman. Strap in. And then it opens in Bhutan, 1995. So right off the bat, I'm thinking, oh, this is actually going to have kind of a epic scope, actually. Especially since it wasn't a 2 minute sequence, then you got a title drop. I mean, it's a lengthy enough prologue.
Yeah, it's a good 10, 12 minutes.
And it looks good. I mean, I was reminded of The Ritual, like I said. The Ritual is a good-looking movie. It's got that sense of hostile wilderness. Both films do, I mean. The elements bearing down on you. And part of the reason, as we mentioned before, that the Bye Bye Man looks the best in that first encounter in the tundra is because he's a black smudge on a white expanse. You just see this Dementor-esque figure kind of coming towards you out of the blizzard. And that was scarier because of the color, the contrast, the striking contrast. That was more impactful for me than when he's a dark smudge in an unlit room, like every other time we see him. You know right. what I mean? Right. So the strobing effect in his final encounter was okay, but the movie never topped that first sighting for me.
Yeah.
And that has to do with the director's eye, the cinematography, like Jim's been saying.
So I think we can pop on over to our recommendations. This movie reminded me of a lot of different movies. It's got that mid to late 90s supernatural crime thriller energy running through it in a big way.
I could tell that you were warming up to it because it kept reminding me a little bit of Fallen.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've already recommended Fallen. I've already sung its praises in another episode of this podcast. So, I mean, I'm going to mention it, but I that can't be my official recommendation again. But yeah, definitely had lots of Fallen energy. To a little bit lesser extent, Stigmata.
I have not seen Stigmata, yeah. Although I remember being a little creeped out by the trailer when I was a tot, 1998 or 9 or so.
Seven a little bit, even though that's not supernatural, but it's got a lot of the same energy mm-hmm. in that
gothic ambiance.
Yeah, John Doe is essentially an almost supernatural force of nature.
Yeah.
Demonic, sort of.
Or like a wrathful angel, one or the other.
Also, a little bit movie like Angel Heart, even though that's late 80s, but it's, again, in that same sort of constellation of movies. Yeah. And then there's one that's a little more contemporary that I'm not 100% behind, but it's kind of off the beaten path, and I'm therefore going to use it for my recommendation. It's a movie Matt and I saw together, I believe, in theaters some years ago. It was called Deliver Us From Evil.
Oh, Eric Bana?
Yeah.
Right? Okay. Yeah.
So, basically, the short version is that Eric Bana is a cop. Go figure. Always a cop. Denzel Washington in Fallen is a cop, etc.
Yeah.
Who basically investigates a series of crimes that have some kind of demonic or possession involvement, and he more or less comes face to face with the devil in the form of one guy in particular. In a lot of ways, it's kind of a schlocky, run-of-the-mill horror movie, but for whatever reason, it's kind of stuck in my brain as being a cut or two above the complete morass of the worst of those movies. And I guess probably because it's a more recent, much like The Empty Man, although I think in the end, The Empty Man's a little bit better. But much like The Empty Man, it's a more contemporary iteration of what I've classified as a mostly mid to late 90s phenomenon that I'm personally fond of.
Oh, we're both still carrying that torch. I love 90s serial killer cinema. I've said as much on the show more than once. You know, I will, if Copycat and Citizen Kane are both playing on TV at the same time, I would be a little bit ashamed to admit which one I am gravitating towards.
So,
and Citizen Kane is not a boring movie, just because it's a classic. It's a very entertaining movie. However, so is Copycat. At least you're wired the way I am.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would say go check out Deliver Us From Evil. I think it's fun. far from a perfect movie, but go for it.
Yeah, I barely remember Deliver Us From Evil, so I can't really lend my voice to that chorus, though I can sing the praises of the subgenre that you're that you're applauding. It is near and dear to me also. I am going to formally recommend Angel Heart, actually.
Okay.
Because Mickey Rourke's character, the protagonist of that movie, like the protagonist of this movie, comes to find that he is not the person he thought he was. And that film ends with a kind of shattering, identity unraveling revelation that works for me better than the one in this film because it is more of a drip feed. But there is also, there is that sense, like in this movie, that he has to be put through his paces. He has to kind of come to it on his own after going through X, Y, and Z experiences. It's not like, you know, obviously there would be no movie if in the first scene he had the epiphany.
Right.
But for shadowy, ritualistic reasons, he kind of has to go through this trial by fire. That's how Kill List works. That's how The Empty Man works. That's how
Shutter Island works.
Yeah. Yeah,
although
right.
That's not a cult thing.
No, in Shutter Island, it's allegedly therapeutic.
Right.
And in a sense, it is in all of them, maybe. In Angel Heart, Mickey Rooney is a private eye.
Mickey Rourke.
Right. Fucking A. That would be a very different movie.
Yeah.
A movie I would watch in a heartbeat. Just spry, diminutive, impish little private eye.
Oh man.
With or without an appalling yellow face.
Oh Christ.
Anyway, Mickey Rourke is working for a client, sinister gentleman played by Robert De Niro, who is obviously the devil. The moment you lay eyes on him, his name is, I think, Louis Cipher, like, you know, Lucifer.
Right.
If you slur your words a little, as Mickey Rourke often does. It's as stupid as Al Pacino's name in Devil's Advocate being John Milton. You know, it's like, go get a deeper cut, you know? It's the third Devil's Advocate reference in as many episodes. So you can kind of see the twist coming a mile away. Maybe not the particulars, but you get the sense that Mickey Rourke is a damned soul, that he's heading out of the frying pan and into the fire. But the revelation when it hits him is prepared for in a way that really resonates with me. It helps that it's kind of an old-fashioned detective story. I mean, it's a period piece. It's set in the 40s, I think. So Rourke's character has this post-war malaise thing going on, this sort of film noir bearing that really does it for me. All of the trappings in that movie, the horror and the PI stuff, they're both shadowy genres. I mean, they really complement each other beautifully. It's a color film. I would have liked to have seen a black and white version of it, but it's underrated, I think. So Angel Heart, there you have it.
Spoilers for Bioshock. I may have been thinking about Bioshock.
You may have been, yeah.
Which is not exactly the formulation that I laid out, but in Bioshock, the repeated phrase is a subliminal command trigger. The phrase is, "Would you kindly," which is said to the player's character by someone he believes is like a friendly advisor over the radio, but who is actually the villain using like a friendly Irish brogue.
He's the obligatory video game go here, do that voice. He's
right.
Navi the fairy. Hey, listen. But Bioshock, in a very mid-2000s kind of make-you-think sort of way, is having fun with the player agency bag. Wow, video games do always just tell you what to do, and you just do as you're told.
Yeah.
I mean, that was pretty groundbreaking in 2007.
Yeah. And again, it's not, obviously, the player character is not repeating a phrase over and over like a parrot, but it is a repeated phrase that helps obstruct issues of the player's memory having been at least partially erased and things of this nature. So that very well may have been what I was thinking of.
Yeah, in Bioshock, you do play an empty man of sorts, like most player characters. Again, Bioshock is having fun with that kind of building block of video games as a genre, or as a medium, not a genre.
Right.
That you're usually playing a blank slate. So Bioshock has some fun with that.
Well, anyway, now that I've had a sufficient epiphany to scratch my itch.
Yeah, a modest epiphany.
I think we can go ahead and wrap up. So until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese, I think.
Maybe.
Or am I?
Or maybe I made you up 3 days ago. This is our first, second podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
In any case, we, as far as he knows, are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you next time.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from The Empty Man, official trailer, 20th Century Studios, uploaded by 20th Century Studios. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, February 7th, and we'll be discussing the Gillian Jacobs Bump in the Night monster movie, Come Play. See you then.